When Kelsey and I got married, one of the things that my parents and my brother and his wife did for us for a wedding present was to buy tickets for a dinner river cruise for our honeymoon. And so they had gone online and found this company that had this riverboat dinner experience. And so they'd printed out the tickets and we'd brought them with us. And it was for, I think, the second or third night that we were there. We were very excited and it was going to be a great experience. And so we got all dressed up in our nicest clothes and we set out and had the clerk at the hotel take our picture, and it was going to be this great occasion, and we weren't familiar with the city, and so we ballparked how long it would take to get from the hotel, and it was a walk, and so we started walking, and of course, we weren't wearing our trainers, our most comfortable shoes, and so we weren't walking at our briskest pace. We started to realize that it was getting pretty close to when that boat was going to be leaving the dock, so we started kind of hustling, kind of running, didn't want to get all sweaty, you know, but wanted to get there on time, and we got to the dock just in time to see the boat pulling away about 100, just outside swimming distance. I briefly toyed with the notion of jumping in the water and swimming hard after the boat. It wasn't going that fast. And so then, of course, on the way back to the hotel, it started to rain to make matters even worse. So we missed out on something. And I'm sure many of us, all of us, at some point have felt like we missed it by that much, as Maxwell Smart used to say, that we just missed out on something by the barest of margins. The passage we're going to look at today is possibly one of the most familiar passages, the most familiar stories for us in all of Scripture. It's certainly one of the most often referred to, and it's about when the people of Israel missed out. It's in Numbers 13, if you'll turn there. It's a very familiar story as they are brought to the edge of the promised land and miss out on entering into what God has promised them. It introduces one of my favorite biblical characters, and so I'm very excited to be able to talk about this story today and to relate it to you, but more importantly, to see what it has to say to us. And so if you'll turn to Numbers 13, but before we do, as a reminder that this story and the stories in Numbers often serve throughout the rest of Scripture and the New Testament as an example, as a paradigm for what it means to follow Christ. And so, Paul, we've looked at part of this passage each of the last two Sundays, but look at what Paul says in 1 Corinthians, beginning in verse 27 of chapter 9. "But I discipline my body and keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. For I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that our fathers were all under the cloud, and all passed through the sea," referring to this pillar of cloud and the crossing of the Red Sea. "And all ate the same spiritual food," referring to the manna that they were provided with. "And all drank the same spiritual drink," referring to the water provided from the rock in the wilderness. "For they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ." Paul begins to make allusion to saying that what happened to the Israelites was more than just a physical set of events, that it was spiritual guidance and redemption that has meaning for us. But look at what he says now. "Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness." He points back to this generation that has seen God's miraculous and redemptive provision and yet missed out. And then the verse that we have looked at each of the last two Sundays. "Now these things happened to them as an example, but they were written down for our instruction on whom the end of the ages has come." There is a clear statement that the events of the book of Numbers, and specifically this episode that we're looking at today, has a bearing for us. We might very well miss out on what God has intended and designed if we are not careful. And so Paul began by saying that he disciplines his body so that he might not be disqualified, even as someone who has preached the gospel to others that they may believe. He recognizes that he himself might miss out. And so the question before us is, first of all, what is it that we might miss out on, and how do we avoid missing out? So Numbers 13, beginning verse 1. "Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, 'Send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the people of Israel. From each tribe of their fathers you shall send a man, every one a chief among them.'" This story is set as the people have traveled from Mount Sinai. It's 11 days' journey if you go in a straight line without any detours or delays, no lunch stops, no potty stops, to get to Kadesh Barnea, where they are on the edge of the land. They've taken about 3 months to get there because remember it says the pillar of cloud, when it stopped, they stopped, and they stopped for however long that cloud stopped. But it's been about 3 months since they set out from Sinai. The first thing I want us to understand that we often miss, and I realize that I had missed, because this story is so familiar, we know how it ends, right? They don't get to go into the land. They spend 40 years wandering in the wilderness. And it's one of those things where the way things end up becomes the way we assume they were supposed to end up. They spent 40 years in the wilderness, so that must have been the plan all along. The first thing I want to point out to us and to remind us of is they're not supposed to be in the wilderness. The only reason they're in the wilderness is because it's between Egypt and the Promised Land and they have to go through. The only reason they spent a year at Sinai was to be informed of who they were and how they were to live distinctly. But now it is time to enter the Promised Land. They are not supposed to be in the wilderness for 1 minute longer. Why? Because God is giving them the land of Canaan. And they've arrived. They're there. It is time to receive what God has promised. They are not supposed to be in the wilderness. And as I reflected on that this week, I realized that oftentimes I tend to assume that my Christian experience is supposed to mirror the wilderness. Now, this is what we are called to, that this is where we are supposed to be, however we conceive of that. And so I've been challenged this week by this notion that no, the wilderness is not the destination. It is not where they are supposed to be. And so they're going to send men in, chiefs among them. These are their Delta Force types. These are their strong military men. These are not weaklings that they send in to spy out the land. And as we read on, beginning in verse 17, Moses sends them out and he gives them a set of instructions. He says, go into the land and they're to spy out two things, two types of things, the land itself and the people who dwell in the land. And Moses presents all of these criteria in binary form, in either ors. Are the people of the land strong or weak? Do they live in walled cities or encampments? Is the land good or is it not? Are there trees or are there not? Are there few people or many people? And so they go into the land with a set of instructions to scout out all of these things, to evaluate both the land and its inhabitants. And as you look at verse 22, they went up into the Negev and came to Hebron. Ahiman, Shishai, and Talmai, the descendants of Anak, were there. These descendants of Anak are giants, enormous physical specimens of human beings that were legendary within the ancient world and show up throughout these narratives in Numbers and Joshua and Judges as fearsome warriors. And so they first see giants, particularly in this location of Hebron, a massive walled city situated on a hill. But then in verse 23, they came to the valley of Eshcol and cut down from there a branch with a single cluster of grapes, and they carried it on a pole between them. They find giants living in giant walled cities on giant hills, but they also find such a large single cluster of grapes that it requires a pole carried between two men to transport it back to Moses and the people of Israel. And so as Moses has set out, scout out the land and see whether the land is good or bad, scout out the inhabitants and see whether they are weak or strong, they discover that the land is indeed good, that it is abundant and fruitful, and that the people are strong, and their cities are strong as well. And so they have come across these two truths, these two giants. And so they come back, they spend 40 days traveling the length and breadth of the land. They return, and they bring this report. It is indeed a land that flows with milk and honey. It is abundant. It is a good land. However, we saw the descendants of the Anakim there. We saw giants in the land. And so they faithfully present both sides of this truth, these 12 spies. And then in verse 30, something interesting is said. They've presented these facts, and the response of the people is not given. But verse 30 starts with this contrast. But Caleb quieted the people before Moses. There's an assumed or implied response of the people that in response to what has just been said, an abundant and fruitful land, however, there are giants, the response seems to have been something akin to the murmuring and complaining and grumbling that we've encountered over the last couple of Sundays. It was not a positive response because Caleb finds it necessary, and the word here is more of a hush. He hushes the people. When it says he quieted them, he's not trying to calm them down. He's literally hushing them up because they're trespassing dangerously close to doubting God's goodness, as we will see. He quiets the people and said, "Let us go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it." Caleb does not dispute anything that the 12 men have said in their report. He agrees. He's part of that report. There's abundant fruit in the land, and there are giants. So let us go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it. His response to the information that he has firsthand is to go up and overcome it. But then the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we are." So you have Caleb on the one hand saying, "We should go up at once and occupy it. We are well able to overcome it." And the other men who went up with him saying, "We are not able, for the people are stronger than we are." And I want to pose something to you, that at this moment, at the end of verse 31, they are both right. Caleb is right. We are well able to overcome it. And the other men are right. They're stronger than us. We are not able to overcome it. The question at this point is not the facts in evidence. The question is the facts not yet in evidence. The land is good and the people are stronger than us. And Caleb looks at that and says, "We should go in." And the other men say, "We should not go in. They're stronger than us." It's what happens in verse 32 where things begin to go awry. So they, the men who had gone up with Caleb, brought to the people of Israel a bad report of the land that they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone to spy it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people that we saw in it are of great height. And there we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak who come from the Nephilim, and we seemed to ourselves like grasshoppers, and so we seemed to them." At this point, it is the fear of the men who had gone up with Caleb that drives them now to lie, to give a bad report, to say it's not a good land, to change the facts, to dissuade the people from desiring to go into the land. Not only can't we take it, we wouldn't want it. Let the Canaanites keep it. It's a land that devours its inhabitants. And so we have to ask the question at this stage, what is it that has gone wrong? What is it that has prompted these men now to fabricate a charge against this land to discourage the people of Israel from going up? And I think we have to look back at chapter 11. Remember when we saw that the people became complainers of evil things? And then it led to those three episodes of grumbling about the lack of meat and Miriam and Aaron complaining against Moses. Something's gone wrong at a far more fundamental level long before this. On the flip side, we would want to ask the question of Caleb. What gives Caleb this assurance? What gives Caleb this confidence to say, "Giants, tall walled cities, bring it on. We can do it." If you look at chapter 14, verse 24 briefly, we get God's commentary on what went right with Caleb. We can speculate on what went wrong with the other spies. But look at what God himself says about Caleb. "But my servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit and has followed me fully, I will bring into the land into which he went, and his descendants shall possess it." Two things are said of Caleb. He has a different spirit and he has followed me fully. I want to submit that just in keeping with what we did with our families of our first graders this morning, what we remind ourselves of every week, what we are calling ourselves to as a strategy of discipleship, is that when a moment of decision comes where our faith and our conviction in what God is calling us to is tested, the time to develop the faith to follow God's leading is not in that moment. The time to develop that faith is right now. The time to develop that faith is yesterday. The time to develop that faith is last year. At the moment of crisis, if we have not developed patterns and habits of trusting in God's promises, we will not trust Him when the crisis hits. The time to develop convictions is before those convictions are tested. And Caleb is said to have followed God fully, to have a different spirit, a spirit that trusts in God's good promises. And I would submit that the other spies and the people of Israel as a whole have failed to develop that faith muscle. And they've demonstrated that consistently to where it should not surprise us that they fail this test. And so chapter 14 records the aftermath of this bad report. The spies give this bad report of the land, and the people of Israel in chapter 14, verse 1, raised a loud cry, and the people wept that night, and all the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. Loud cries, weeping, grumbling. The whole congregation said to them, "Would that we had died in the land of Egypt. Or would that we had died in this wilderness. Why is Yahweh bringing us into this land to fall by the sword?" Do you hear the doubt? Do you hear the accusation against God? God's promises are not good, is what they're saying. The land He has brought us to is a death trap. It would have been a kindness to leave us in Egypt, or to kill us in this wilderness. Our wives and our little ones will become a prey. Would it not be better for us to go back to Egypt? And they said to one another, "Let us choose a leader and go back to Egypt. Let us go back to death," they say. Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before all the assembly of the congregation of the people of Israel. And Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. It's interesting, this is the first mention of Joshua in this narrative. And similarly to how in Acts, Barnabas is the one that brings Saul along, and then Saul supplants him and goes further than Barnabas in ministry, I think we're seeing something similar here. Joshua gets all the press, but I think if not for Caleb, Joshua is a work in progress. And Joshua doesn't become the faithful and bold and courageous leader that eventually leads the wilderness generation in the conquest of the land 40 years from now if he doesn't have Caleb's faith as a model. This is an illustration of what discipleship does. Caleb is able to transfer his faith in God's good promises into the life of Joshua. And Joshua then builds on that and goes further than even Caleb did. And they said to all the congregation of the people of Israel, "The land which we passed through to spy it out is an exceedingly good land." They contradict the report of the 10 spies. And incidentally, to the Sunday school teachers in the room, it is all I can do this morning not to burst out in song, 10 were bad and 2 were good, but I spare you all. "If Yahweh delights in us," verse 8, "He will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land that flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against Yahweh and do not fear the people of the land. For they are bread for us. Their protection is removed from them, and Yahweh is with us." Underline that. Do not fear them. They present the facts that had not been introduced into evidence yet directly. The deciding factor, a good land that God has promised, and giants in walled cities. The reason that Caleb's faith is appropriate is because Yahweh is with us. Their protection is removed. They've lost their rights to the land. And we've seen this said at least 2 or 3 times. God will give it to us. That's why Caleb says, we don't have to go in and take it. We just have to go in and occupy it. But we do have to go in, believing that God is with us. And verse 10 is one of the most tragic verses. "Then all the congregation said to stone them with stones." They had had the audacity to suggest that the God of Isaac and Abraham and Jacob had kept his promises to them. Let's kill them. How dare they suggest that God had been faithful? But I love the end of verse 10. But the glory of Yahweh appeared at the tent of meeting to all the people of Israel. God intervenes to protect his faithful servants who have upheld his name. It is God who is on trial by the people of Israel, being accused of not delivering his good promises to them. And God upholds the witness of his servants by intervening his glory. And here again, we've read it, it's familiar to us, and I find it perplexing, but it's at the crux of this. These 10 spies, the people of Israel, they've seen this. For the last 18 months, they've seen this pillar of cloud and pillar of fire. They've seen bread miraculously appear to feed them. They've seen water gushing from rocks. They've seen the Red Sea parted and the most mighty military force in the world drowned when they passed through on dry ground. They've seen 10 plagues unseat the most powerful nation on earth. How is it that they do not believe that God will bring them into this land? I want to submit to you that their problem is not a lack of information. Their problem is not even a failure to agree with true statements about God. Their failure is a failure to follow through. Their failure is a failure to act, to recognize that a response to truth is the measure of faith. And so God now asks the question in verse 11. And Yahweh said to Moses, "How long will this people despise me? And how long will they not believe in me in spite of all the signs that I have done among them?" God now says it straight out. I've done all this. I've proven it. All of these different ways. How long will they despise me? How long will they not believe in me? How long will they not trust in me and place their confidence in me? I will strike them with pestilence and disinherit them, and I will make of you a nation greater and mightier than they. If they don't want a part in my promises, I'll write them off and I'll start over with you, Moses. This parallels the incident of the golden calf, where God threatened much the same thing, and Moses, again, to his credit, demonstrating this sort of faith and understanding, engages in this intercession, saying, "God, no, that won't work." And the reason it won't work is because Egypt will hear of it, and the people of the land will hear of it, and they will say what your people are saying, which is that you are not able to deliver on your good promises. See, they've been faithless. They've challenged you. Believe me, I get it, Moses says, in essence. But don't prove them right. They're saying you're unable to deliver on your promises. Prove them wrong. Prove that you are able to keep your promises. And so look at what he says in verse 17. "And now please let the power of the Lord be great as you have promised." The power of the Lord to bring them into the land? Well, sort of. Look at what he says. Saying, "Yahweh is slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love, forgiving iniquity and transgressions. But he will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generation. Please pardon the iniquity of this people according to the greatness of your steadfast love, just as you have forgiven this people from Egypt until now." Moses says, "God, your power is found in your ability to take these rotten, faithless people and save them anyway. Don't shortchange your power by wiping them out. Your promise has always been based on your faithfulness, never on theirs. Don't demonstrate an inability to save faithless people." And so God says, "All right, I will keep my promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but this generation misses out. Everything they said that would happen to their children will happen to them. And it will be their children that will get to inherit the land." And so fast forwarding, right before we head into Advent, we will be in Joshua, where we see the generation that comes 40 years later. They have to be shepherds in the wilderness because of their parents' sin. Imagine those conversations around the dinner table for the next 40 years. Another day in the wilderness. Thanks a lot, Mom and Dad. Just waiting for you to die, in case you are interested. Again, the 40 years in the wilderness are so ingrained in our thinking that we forget what that period of time was about. It was waiting for 600,000 people to die. And when that last funeral was done, now we can go in. Awkward family conversations around the dinner table, I'm sure. Well, this generation just never seems to get anything right. And so they understand that they've messed up. They understand that they've missed out. And so in verse 42, they say, we're going to go up. All right, we get it. We'll go in. And Moses says, no, don't go up. And here's the key phrase, for the Lord is not among you. They made the mistake of thinking that God couldn't deliver them. And now they make the mistake of thinking they can deliver themselves. They're going to go up presumptuously without God's presence. Verse 43, because you have turned back from following Yahweh, Yahweh will not be with you. But they presumed to go up to the heights of the hill country, although neither the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh nor Moses departed out of the camp. Then the Amalekites and the Canaanites who lived in that hill country came down and defeated them and pursued them even to Hormah. The distinguishing fact is the presence of God. Everybody saw it. Everybody knew, including the Egyptians and the people in the land, that God was with them. Everyone knew it. Only Moses, Aaron, Caleb, and Joshua trusted it. Only Moses, Aaron, Caleb, and Joshua could look at the giants and the walled cities and say, the presence of God overrules that. The promises of God are greater than that. Four men in the entire congregation were the only ones who trusted in what everyone knew to be true. Everyone knew God was in their midst. You could see it. Only four men trusted it to make a difference. The rest said, let's go back to death. Let's go back to Egypt. So this story could end on a really sad note, but I love chapter 15. And this is one of those parts where if you read through the book of Numbers for your devotions at any point, you get to chapter 15 and say, wait, we were in the middle of a story and now there's all these rules about sacrifices. Yahweh spoke to Moses saying, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land. Immediately after telling them, you're not going in now, God indicates you will go into the land. And when you do, my presence will be maintained among you through the system of sacrifices by which forgiveness for sins will be made available. And he gives these extensive directions. But then at the end of the chapter, if you read all the way through, he talks about sins committed with a high hand, presumptuously challenging God's goodness versus sins that are committed unintentionally. And it said that sins committed with a high hand, there is no sacrifice for. But unintentional sins are what is provided for. As I said, this story gets a lot of press in the rest of Scripture. And if you turn to Hebrews, this is what the author of Hebrews does with this story for us and informs our response. The author of Hebrews is exhorting his people, his congregation, to be faithful. And he says, therefore, as the Holy Spirit says, quoting Psalm 95, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion. On the day of testing in the wilderness, where your fathers put me to the test and saw my works for 40 years, therefore I was provoked with that generation and said, they always go astray in their heart. They have not known my ways. As I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Take care, brothers and sisters, lest there be in any of you an evil, unbelieving heart leading you to fall away from the living God. And the remedy is to exhort one another day after day, as long as it is called today, that none of you may be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. And then in verse 16 of chapter 3, he says, for who were those who heard and yet rebelled? Was it not all those who left Egypt led by Moses? And with whom was he provoked for 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned, whose bodies fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who were disobedient? So we see that they were unable to enter because of unbelief. He goes on to speak about this promise of rest and that we need to be careful lest we fail to reach it because of unbelief. And so the question for me, as we consider what we're to do with this, the promise of God's promised land that he gives to the people is this destination where he leads them into an abundant life. And the parallel in the New Testament, what Paul analogizes that to, is the indwelling presence of the Spirit of God. And I find that for myself, I often doubt whether or not the indwelling presence of the Spirit of God actually changes things. Because we look around and there be giants, right? There are walls around us. There are things that seem to stand opposed to God and his promises, and it looks like they are stronger than we are. And yet we should know better than the people of Israel that God is really and truly in our midst. And we do know better. But the question is, do we believe it? Do we trust it? Do we confidently assume what Caleb confidently assumed, that when presented with those challenges, we are surely able to overcome it? Let us go up at once and occupy it. Do we look at the dangers in the world? Do we look at the opposition in the world to God and his kingdom and shrink back, to borrow the language of the author of Hebrews, or do we move forward boldly, knowing that God is with us and trusting his presence? This has been on my mind a lot lately. And as we talk about beginning a new strategy of discipleship, and I would encourage you, we're having a leaders orientation and session next Sunday at 9 a.m. You're not committing to anything by showing up. This is not just another Bible study to indoctrinate us in the knowledge of the faith. We know what we believe. The question is, do we believe it? Do we really trust it? And I have been exploring this in a number of sources, and one of those is from the president of my parents' missions agency, and he writes this about John Wimber, who you may be familiar with. He was the primary catalyst behind the Vineyard movement, and he'd been immersed in the secular music industry. He was the business manager for the Righteous Brothers when he became a committed follower of Jesus. He read through the New Testament and fell in love with Jesus. He was awed at what Jesus did. He was amazed and drawn to the stories of the miraculous and of supernatural reality. When he became a Christian, he thought that's what he was going to be doing. He thought the stuff he read about in the New Testament would be normal, but was stunned when he visited some existing churches. Here's what he said. I remember the frustration of attending church the first few times, and I thought, this is great. I'm going to join up. I want to do this stuff. You know what I thought they did at church? This is how stupid I was. I thought people gathered at the church, had a good time together, sort of divided up the land, then everybody went out, healed a few people, cast out a few demons, and won a few people to Christ before lunch. When they didn't do it, I was disappointed. So I asked one of the leaders, when are we going to go do it? He told me, oh, you don't have to do it. You just have to believe it was done once. His words, that's pathetic. I found out over the next year or two that we cried about it, we sang about it, we preached about it, we prayed over it, we gave to it, but we never did it. We never got to do the things that Jesus did, and I grew disillusioned in the process. You know, when I worked for the devil, he let me do his stuff. But when I came to work for Jesus, people didn't want to let me do his stuff. Tell you the truth, I joined up to do the stuff. Somewhere, someplace, somebody has to begin believing this book and acting on it. And it might as well be us. Do we really believe that the presence of God means that the giants and the walls in our world come tumbling down when we move out in faith? Do we really believe it? Father God, give us hearts of faith. Give us the boldness of Caleb. Give us the faith of Joshua. Give us the perspective to see that your presence among us makes a difference, that it changes things, that the gospel is good news, that it means the defeat of the powers and the principalities that have the world enslaved. Show us where you are working and how we are to follow, and give us the hearts not hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. but emboldened and dwelt by your Spirit to live courageously in this dark world.